We thought about talking a bit more about history and prehistory, or the kind of histories that we can imagine before the history that you can find in the school books. In the previous talk about history, I described how arbitrary history can be and how political and religious people can be about history. That aside, as we have already looked at that, what can we do with all these different accounts of the history before history? And evidently, you can find a lot of stories, you can find a lot of fake stories, you can a lot of falsified stories. So, what to do with all of that? Because, as discussed in the previous talk, history serves a political agenda, just as is the case for religion. So there is a strong point in understanding that history also often is a religious concept, something that people are asked to believe in. But now let's look at what stories are out there. Conventional history presents a picture that there is a succession of cultures. So, for example, from the West, they present the notion that the Western world is the most powerful ever been, and the whole lot. And when you see the map, you can see that Europe is right in the middle of the map. And when you look at the real maps of the Earth, you can find that the picture of the world map has been distorted. Europe is presented far too large. Africa, South America, and so on are presented far too small. So when you actually find a true scale model of the Earth, and you can see that Europe is very small, and that there's a lot of other countries out there. The same is the case for history. There is a description of history, which is amplified, put in the center of the picture, and you're not supposed to see that there are other parts of history out there. There's this, the talk about the prehistory of South America, which everybody happily ignores, because if you realize that that was a very advanced and civilized culture, which was massacred by the Spaniards, in part conscientiously and intentionally, and in part by their lack of hygiene and the diseases that they brought along, then people don't think too well about eradicating a very advanced culture. So then, from the perspective of history, it is simpler to say that those are just stupid people who live there. We can happily ignore them, treat them like beasts. And in fact, that's what the Catholic Church and others have been saying for quite a while about anybody who was not part of their group. So we need to look beyond that part of derogatory kind of history and realize that the Indians in North America had a very peaceful society in balance with nature, and the North Americans can learn a lot from that. Actually, in the Book of the Hopi by Frank Waters, they have histories of the Native American peoples, describing how they traveled from Siberia into North America and then all the way down to South America and back up again, discovering all of the countries and building their monuments and temples and living in peace with the land. To pretend that these people don't have a culture and don't have a history and are just drunks in camps, concentration camps, which are called reservations, is a distortion of the facts. These people had an advanced civilization. They were not so much into the material stuff and more into the spiritual stuff, so they didn't need many things physical to demonstrate what they were doing, because it was all about what you became rather than what you had. And that, of course, is also what happened in South America. And the South American cultures and continent, it was evident that these peoples had roads with a separator, a divider in the middle of the road, that they had very good irrigation systems. And when I was in Colombia last, there was a bath in the river, which showed that they understood hydro engineering, but even to a deeper level, the organization of this bath was so well conceived that the water from one area would go into the other and would mix and specific kind of turbulence before it could go on. And you really need to understand hydrodynamics and water engineering to see that with the kind of linear flow and turbulent flow and vertical flow, they were actually changing the quality of water, the same as is known for the Roman aqueducts, where they were very careful to get water into the city from 30, 50 or even more kilometers away, and thus show that they had an understanding of qualities of water which are different from just turning on the tap and something clear liquid comes out. They realize that one type of water is not the other, and likewise in this say water computer in this bath in Colombia, you can say that there is a lot of understanding there. Evidently in South America there were many other examples of very advanced cultures, large sculptures, the Nazca landing strips, as they're thought to be, or the cities where the stones are so interlocked that some people have even suggested that they were cut with laser and fit in place. And actually there have been indications that when you look at some of these temples that you can identify the spot where the laser would have stood, because when you look at the edges of the windows and the edges of some of the rocks, they all have this center point where they all seem to converge. So let's just put into the understanding of the history and prehistory that we do have buildings and building sites, but also landscapes and landscape sites, which have been intentionally created by humans for a specific purpose. Let's also add to that the understanding that some of these building sites, such as the pyramids, which are spread all over the world, and one of my friends in England, a former navigator for the Royal Air Force, he was plotting the location of all of these pyramids and indicated that they were all on specific lines on the earth, the ground lines or the ground circles, and that once you understand that these kind of circles exist on the planet for the simple reason that these pyramids and structures are built as points on those lines with rather great precision, then before those structures were built there, somebody must have already understood about the existence or the importance of such circles or lines. So were these points, say acupuncture points, on meridians of the earth, or was there another purpose? These kind of questions have been asked for a very long time already, and every time it turns out that history indicates that there was a kind of understanding which got lost. So the notion that we are the best and the most advanced civilization on the planet, and that we deserve to put Europe on the middle of the map and make it seem to be larger than it is a false perspective. We need to realize that in history there are many examples of structures and other artifacts which indicate that cultures have existed long ago, which were already very advanced, and maybe in some respects further advanced than we are now. Of course, politicians dislike the notion that they would be the best people available, and they dislike the notion that there would be heroes from the past who got things sorted out better. But nevertheless, there are all these pyramids. There are the underwater pyramids in Japan. There are the underwater cities of, it's said to be the city of Shiva in India, in Malta, just off the coast. There are these big ruins which indicate that the water level would have been lower, and that underwater now there were large civilizations. Of course, Michael Telegram in South Africa has shown that there are mega cities spread all over Africa, and many of them have round architectural shapes. And as he pointed out, these cities are built using stones which have very specific qualities for sound and vibrations. And his hypothesis is that they actually are, in a way, piezoelectric. That is, that they can use the vibrations of sound to release an electrical charge from the rocks. And lithium, which is Nelson's interpretation of biological process lithium, also has that kind of characteristic, that you can put it by the roadside and the vibrations of the traffic will release electricity from this biological lithium, which he combined his name with the word lithium. If people like him can find those kind of materials, then other people would have found something like that as well. And we need to enlarge our perspective and understand that in the West, they count their year count in say, it is now the year 2000 and a bit. And the Muslims say, well, actually, they're 600 years behind. And in a specific way, they are. And in that same way, the Hebrew tribe says that the Christians are a couple of thousand years behind, because they say that, according to their calendar, things would have started around 5,000 years ago. And I once spoke with a rabbi who then said that, okay, that was the day that God created the earth. And so when I asked him, well, so how about these dinosaurs? His answer, and his belief was very simple, he said, well, when God made the earth, it was made to look old. And so you go to the shop and you buy yourself this freshly made antique. Evidently, there are many indicators that this is not the case. There are cultures which have a much older history than just the 5,000 years of the Hebrew tribe. When you look at the Egyptians, they go back 10,000 years, 35,000 years more. Probably 100,000 years. There are indications that in the Pyramid of Giza, in this little chamber where they supposedly had the production of hydrogen gas, water gas, so they split water into oxygen and hydrogen, that on the top of that little chamber was the map of the constellations, in which the constellations of the planets were indicated, stars. So by that they realized that that was much older than they had ever thought. And Anthony West and others have already indicated that this notion of the history of Egypt, as it is portrayed in the books, is maybe of political interest, but not of historical interest, because there are many things which indicate that the history of Egypt is far older than what is portrayed in the books. There are many people who tried to correct the history of, say, Egypt and Assyria, and some of them, like Velikovsky, tried to compare the history as it was recorded in Egypt with the history as recorded in Assyria, and then discovered that there were huge gaps in the history on the one side and the other, in the way that it was described by the historians. And so when he rectified it, he realized that timelines were very different. And so it's a good idea to read his books to get an understanding of why and how he did that time correction on that history, of which was basically just the prehistory of Europe. I'll never forget that the Europeans were sort of landlocked in their belief that Europe was the only thing that was, until the 1913s and thereabout, when the information from China and the East and Far East came into Europe in larger amounts. The Jesuits had brought in the books from the other cultures. They had been translated by Müller and others. And only then was it possible to start to think in a different way. And not too soon after the I Ching was translated, the theory of relativity and quantum theory originated in the same area, by the way, around Vienna, in the Wiener Kreis. So the notion that Europe was the only thing was interesting but limited, and expanding that to include from Europe the Roman history, and then the Greek history, and before that the Egyptian history, was only part of the extension of the understanding of the scope of history. And it is very remarkable that the Moorish culture in Andalusia, in the south of Spain, was happily ignored in this, because those were the Moors, so why do you need to reckon and account for them in the history of Europe? Because they weren't Christians, so what did they have to contribute? Well, what they contributed was the whole Enlightenment and the rebirth of reason, because those were the guys who still had translated in Arabic the Greek and Roman texts. So a lot of the history of Rome and of Greece became available after the Dark Middle Ages, let's say the Catholic Middle Ages, only when the Moorish culture inheritance was added to the understanding of Europe. So then you see that from the present time going back, you have this Renaissance and the rebirth of Enlightenment, which means that when you go back further, you have to go to Andalusia for a while and realize that that's where the culture was, and go back. Then you see that there is Rome, and Rome of course got their slaves and their teachers from Greece. Greece got their knowledge from Egypt. Rome later got it from Egypt too, so we need to extend it back to Egypt. It took a long time before they could actually decipher and decode the language of the Egyptians, the hieroglyphs. They started to get a better understanding on the Babylonian and Assyrian culture, and then of course the Americans pillaged the Museum of Baghdad intentionally, on purpose. They destroyed that cultural inheritance, because if you can eliminate somebody's culture, you can present the notion that they don't exist that long. But no, the Assyrian culture was there already. So then, together with the Egyptians and Assyrians, you know, to go back 30,000 years, probably 100,000 years, probably much further. And to understand how far you need to go back in history, you need to of course go back to the Indian and the Chinese cultures, and then you have to go back a couple of 10,000 years here and there. And 35,000 years ago, already there were scripts in China on how to do Qigong exercises and get rid of all kind of diseases. Then we're still not far away back enough. Then you find the text like Laird Scranton on the Dogon. So that's 40,000 years ago, and they already knew how the cosmos originated They describe the origin of the cosmos, the origin of matter, the origin of the molecules of life, and the origin of social structure in life forms. So if that was there already 40,000 years ago, then what was going on in Africa before that? And nowadays they happily present the idea that Africa was an ignorant place and not important. And evidently, when in Rome they talk about the Christian tradition and they have this nice white guy hanging on a cross crucified by the Jews by means of the Romans, whether it's true or false, people will still have to find out. But that story, if it was true, was an Egyptian story, a North African story. So these were African people. And then as African people, you can see that the biblical story, when they call people Moses or Tutmosis, you suddenly see that you are finding Egyptians' names in the stories. You need to go back further, because the Egyptians describe how they got their gold and their knowledge from Africa. Then you run into names like Timbuktu, which the English sort of put in a derogatory kind of term of way out nowhere. But at that time they had a apparently formidable library in Timbuktu, and you don't find much about that in the Western culture, but in the Moorish tradition they are very clear on how that was one of very many sites of culture and advanced civilization in Africa. And the Moors are also very clear on how they already connected to America. They traveled to America, and when you look into documentaries like The Hidden History, you find that the Africans will indicate that you can find Africans in China, Africans in Japan, Africans in South America, Africans all over the place. They're just written off as, well, these are a strange kind of Japanese, or these are kind of a strange kind of Chinese. But from the African perspective, it is very easy. Those are their ancestors who wandered out and already lived there, and then suddenly the history goes back a lot further. Of course, the difficulty with those kind of historical descriptions is that they're not written records, and the West loves written record because their whole administration and the whole control system relies on the word, the biblical notion, and the record, a Roman notion. So when people have an oral tradition, it is often denied as, well, that was never written down, so that doesn't really count. Well, sometimes it was written down, and for example, I mentioned at some point that in British Columbia and Canada, they had this story where the Indians said that there was this whale that swam up the river, got stranded, and died there. And it took quite a while, and then they did find that whale, and it discovered that that story was 10,000 years old. That means an oral record does have that kind of persistence in memory. And what makes it different from written record? Well, the one is spoken and the other is written down, but both of them are memories which are kept. In this way we can look back in history and see that we need to unfold our scope. And it's a bit as if you live somewhere on the land and you're out in the dark because it is night, and then dawn comes, the earth rotates so that the sun becomes visible again, and the light is seen to flow over the earth again. And then at first you cannot see very much. Actually, the Muslim culture has this moment of discernment between night and day, if you can discern a black and white thread from each other. So there is a point at dawn where a kind of different clarity comes in. If you look in the eyes, it is the the cones which start to take place, take a predominant place in the visual system. So it's either the peripheral system of perception, which is more black and white, or the central visual center, which works with color detection. So when you shift from the one to the other, when you go from peripheral vision to central focused vision, it's that kind of perception which we also have in history. We need to actually go from central focused vision, leaving behind the notion that the Europeans are the best there ever was. No, they were not, because if you start to use peripheral vision, there is a lot more that you can find around. You can see that history goes back much further, much farther, much longer, and you can see that memories are much more available than they were ever thought. It simply means that when Earth expands, layers of soil are blown on top of everything. So, like Schliemann looking for Troy, you have to dig down to find the history. But you also have to dig down in the memories to find the history. And just as we have our ideas, and then we sort of vaguely remember them, and at some point have forgotten them, unless they're triggered, and at some point don't even know that we know it. And actually that's the definition of culture, the sum total of everything that you have forgotten. Then in that sense we can see that the history of humanity is much larger and much more encompassing. But we then also run into this vague area when we go from the twilight zone from one side to the other, from the clear understanding of what we know now into the darkness of what have been forgotten. Then in the forgotten, people stumble into terms such as Atlantis, Lemuria, and other periods of history. And some people have described that in fact this whole planet has been rebooted six times already, so this would be the seventh time. Which means that at the next reboot it would be number 8, which would be an octave, so it could actually go into a more coherent version of everything that has been before. That is how it is then seen in these approaches where the histories of histories are looked into. That means that there are histories which are not continuous, that there are histories where we are not having a simple Darwinian story of how there are humans and then there were dinosaurs and then there were all kind of other forms before that. But no, actually there are the cultures and civilizations that we have now, the ones that came before, Atlantis, Lemuria, and the ones that came before that, Mu and others. And when you compare those comments or these notions of different cultures, it can be found that there are more cultures who have that notion. Just as worldwide there is this notion that say 35,000 years ago ETs came to Earth, built pyramids, and then 10,000 years ago disappeared again. Likewise there are a lot of indications in history, and as mentioned before, you need to expand the notion of written history and add to that the oral history. Then these other stories add the existence of these other cultures. And from the perspective of the history books, you could easily say, well, the history books don't talk about Atlantis, so we can happily ignore that. And then when you go from one school to the other, you will learn that the Greeks actually did talk about Atlantis. In the text of Plato there is a reference to that. So the question then arises, okay, if Atlantis might have existed, where would it be? Would it be Santorini, which was a part of the area of Crete, which was the culture before the Greeks? So was it part of that, and then it got blown up, so they say it disappeared underwater? or was it a piece of a continent between Europe, Africa, and North and South America? And when you look on the globe, you can see that those continents fit very well together. So then you would have to look, is there an area where something is lacking? And using the satellite imaging techniques, is there a piece of land which is raised with respect of the ocean bed between Europe and Africa on the one side and North and South America on the other side? Perhaps not. Yes, there are pyramids and structures which are found in the water in between, so it's not clear who built that. There are also indications that South Pole District is much more interesting and much more encompassing than is normally referred to. There are also indications that that was actually a center point of the period ice map, which means that people already knew about that kind of world mapping and thus history of the world and connectedness of the world long before it was known in Europe. Still, it doesn't help to understand what Atlantis was and what Lemuria was. So then you need to look at other indicators. Is there something else that you can go by? And then, of course, you run into these strange kind of stories of, for example, this little boy in India who was born in the village, and at the moment that he could speak and walk, he said, I'm in the wrong place, I have to go back. And he ran away to this other village a bit further down where he said that he lived. And so he ran into this house, which he said was his house, ran up to these people who he said were his parents, and then they discovered that those parents had had a son who had died. And he said, yeah, I'm that son. But he was not that son because he had been born to other parents. So that's where in India and elsewhere on the planet they have a lot of stories of reincarnation, of memories of the past. And in the same way that this boy remembered where he had lived before and indicated and recognized places, through hypnotic therapy and paranormal research, and never forget that the top scientists in England actually were the creator of the Psychic Research Institute, the Paranormal Research Institute in London. So at the moment that they started to realize that there was something like electricity, which was deeper and more fundamental than matter and molecules, they looked for connections at that level and also sought for ways of understanding how, with electromagnetic fields, information might be transferred or stored, maintained. So they did a lot of research on regression, memory, hypnosis, different kinds, and discovered that some people actually had memories of hundreds of years before. I forget the title of the book, which is about, I think it was even called Bridie Murphy, somebody who had memories of a place where they lived before, and when they went there they could recognize the landscape, they could recognize the houses. So the story which somebody just had seemed to be mumbling under hypnosis actually could be recognized. And in that same way there are people who have stories of Atlantis. And for example, if you look in the story of Damanhur in Italy, you can find that it is somebody who has memories from Atlantis who created that. I met a couple of people who, separate from each other, had memories from Atlantis. The one a musician, the other inventor. And the inventor is creating electronic devices which don't use electricity in a way it is done in books. He studied physics and he works with technology of physics, but he uses other approaches as well. Something which is also described for Nikola Tesla, a very fine thread, so there's no power that can run through it, but nevertheless electric fields can be oriented by it. That is something that has been described from various sources as being a property of what happened in Atlantis, as opposed of the people in Lemuria who basically lived with nature. Note the similarities that in Atlantis it was a technological environment, and Lemurians are said to be a nature-oriented environment, a nature-spiritual-oriented environment. And when you look in the history of Europe, you find that Egypt, say, a technological society, they built the pyramids and they had electric devices and they worked with cosmic models and temples which used vibrations of sound to do the healing. You can still find those. And in Assyria they were more into sexual and genetic understanding or genetic manipulation with hanging gardens, but also say the sexual witchcraft, which essentially is that level of sexuality where consciousness is triggered and enhanced. And again, you have a technological and a biological society next to each other, and in that sense Atlantis and Lemuria are part of that story. When you go back further in expanding the mindset of what you can read about and discover about the prehistory, which is not in history books, then evidently people have stories about the pyramids and Stonehenge and all these other temples worldwide, connected to stories of different kind of properties and characteristics around these kind of buildings, architectures. The Dragon Project in England, which researched Avebury, Stonehenge, and the turning of the electrical currents around the rocks at the turning of the phase of the moon. So when the moon was full, the spiral on the stones, which was going one way, then went the other way after. So that indicates that there is something going on with those stones, which is at the fringe or the edge of what people understand now, because electricity is still not understood in the way it connects us with consciousness and with life. But there were examples of buildings which seemed to understand that and were positioned in the land in such a way that they could actually say have an electric effect on the information balancing of the landscape and thus on the growth of the plants, maybe also on telecommunication. There are many stories on that. That of course is the twilight zone of history, where people will then have stories of something that they might have remembered or might have half forgotten. As for example the story of the whale who got stranded in the river in Canada, as remembered by the Indians. But when people have memories like that and they try to pass them on from generation to generation, of course you will have some pranksters who use those stories to make new stories or to change the stories, and you end up with a bunch of varieties of the same story, and then it becomes quite difficult to know which is the original story. Which is the original story about Atlantis, Lemuria, and what are the original stories about the giants and the other peoples that lived on the planet, what to do with the original stories that just as we have eight chakras which all have different colors, that likewise you have the black rays, the red rays, the orange rays, the yellow rays, the green rays, the blue rays, and the violet rays. And what happened to some of those races? Where are they now? Did they merge or did they die out? The notion of history in that larger perspective is of course all from storytelling. And when you work with stories like those, I have the simple assumption that I listen to the stories as they come, because that's the only way that apparently they can be told. So I accept them at face value and in a way, store them in our memory banks and then let them sit and collect other stories. And when I was in the British Library in London, in that way I was reading the different stories of the different cultures, of the different time zones, different periods, different eras, and discovered that many of the stories had a lot of similarity to them. And people have noticed that. There are many other people who are looking at world development and world culture in this way. They basically read everything, they accept everything at face value, and then start to connect the dots. So how is the Popol Vuh related to the Egyptian Book of the Dead? Does that actually describe the same or similar as the Tibetan Book of the Dead? How does that connect to the Chinese stories about the same? In that way, you can then superimpose those stories and look for common themes and common concepts, and discover that each in their own way try to describe something which is indescribable. Just like I try to describe what happens in a computer when the software is moving in a computer. You can't. You cannot describe what the software is doing in a computer. You can describe that there's an electric field. You can describe that there are currents. You can describe that there are radio parts in the computer. You can describe that it is a structure as a whole which interplays with that software. But the software itself, how visible is that if you take away the computer and there are no parts where current can go through? Is there something like the ghost of a computer program? Evidently, for people there is something like that. That's a story in itself. But is there something like that for the collective mindset of humanity too? The ghost of history. And that is something where people are then looking for a different kind of understanding. Yes, there are these relics which show that dinosaurs were on the earth. The Egyptians have texts in which they consider the Pteranodon a pest, so that the dinosaur flying reptiles are perhaps not that long ago. There are quite a series of debates which come up, especially in that interplay between religion and science, which is the difference between the belief and observation, where scientists who are religious will want to uphold the story that they're spoon-fed through the Bible and other means, because they're told this is true. So they're told that the virgin mother can have a son, and they're told that all kind of other things, and they're told to believe that. But belief is knowledge which is not validated. It is accepted at face value, but it is not questioned. As I said, when I listen to these stories of the past, I accept them at face value, but I do not process them as a belief. I just process them as a story. They are not real, they are not unreal, they're just a story. And then with that story, with that information, you can compare it to other information which is just another story, and that doesn't make the story more real or more unreal. It's still just a story. The only question is, with that information which you get from it, from the understanding of the Egyptians and the Assyrians, or the Atlanteans and the Lemurians, and way back, the humans and the giants, the humans and the did the humans write the dinosaur, yes or no? According to the biblical story, that would well be possible. According to the Darwinian story, that would not be possible. But both of them are projections into the past of ideas which are created in the present. As I mentioned in the other story on history and the revising of history by political and religious means, You can see that the notion of history cannot be tested, just in the same way that you cannot test astrophysics. There's nobody who can report what's actually going on these far stars. We can infer and interpret signals and turn them into information, but that doesn't mean that it is actually so. It just means that we can come up with an understanding which can make sense to us, but perhaps we should rather say that we have given sense to those bits of information and as a result can work with them better. So in our mind we can process that information better because we gave it a specific kind of meaning, but that doesn't mean that it has or had that meaning. Same for history. So yes, there are findings of giant skulls. So why are they not in the history books? Yes, there are crystal skulls carved out of quartz, which have specific properties. People are aware that they actually seem to store information, and you need to use light in a specific way to retrieve that information. And so some people have understood that there is something like that going on with these crystal skulls. And I always jokingly say, well, when the archaeologists of now or a century ago were going out to this place where they dug up things, how many of the floppy disks of the past did they just throw away because they thought that they were just pebbles? We need to understand that our model of history is very much limited by our projection of our presence onto the past. But if we project our present onto the past, we cripple our perception. We limit what we can see, because in a way we're just myopic. We can see about 30 centimeters ahead of us, and then we pretend that what we see in those 30 centimeters applies for 3 meters or 30 kilometers or 300,000 miles away. That doesn't work like that. If you look at a different scope, you need to understand it in a different manner. You need to expand your mind in a different way. And that, I think, is the main role of history, that you learn to expand your mind. You learn to realize that it could have been differently. It might have been differently. Maybe it has been differently. If it has been differently, then what is so special about what is happening now? How could it have been otherwise? How can you improve on what's going on now? And then you can learn from history and extend the understanding of that imagined or fantasized or reconstituted image of history to expand our understanding of ourselves and how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to others, and how we relate to the planet, how we relate all to all life forms. And that kind of information is very much needed. The human species has been destroying life on Earth for hundreds of years, probably longer, and specifically the last years and the last decennia, humans have destroyed much more than they could ever imagine. There is much more that people destroyed that they didn't even know of. And then it is necessary to realize that history is in its way also the graveyard of everything that has been destroyed. You find the leftovers of things that have been. In the Acropolis, you can see the memory of what the people were celebrating at that time. But why have the Greeks in the present not use glass to take the place of the pieces of the temple that are missing, and using glass blocks rebuild the temples? Evidently, when the Sultan in Cairo ripped away the surface layer of the pyramid, then the electromagnetic properties of that pyramid were lost. So yes, it's interesting to have a pyramid on the one side and a mosque on the other side, but the original pyramid had properties which now no longer has. And it is, it requires a kind of respect for history to be able to learn from history. If you just look at history and say, well, oh, this is a large interesting building. Oh, look at all these scrolls, how well they burn. And down goes the whole Library of Alexandria, just because there's some ignorant leader who doesn't understand that people need to understand more than they know already. And so the destruction of knowledge and the destruction of memory is a political act, and is a very destructive act. It is a kind of murder of the soul of people. And the distortion of history and the distortion of the memory of the past is likewise a kind of crippling of the soul of humanity. And in what I'm doing, of course, I try to find out how the principles of the universe operate within us, how our body operates by those principles, how in our mind we can recognize those principles. And from that perspective, everything we see around us is an expression of what we are and what we can be. And for that reason, I have looked at history, but I also discovered that I have to be very cautious in looking at history, for the simple reason that there is too much political propagandizing on history and too much political distortion of history. And that was the previous talk on history where I explained that. So when I look at what people are able of and what they can do, then history helps me a lot. But when I look into history and the text of histories, I find that very quickly I'm caught in this quagmire and this quicksand of opinions about opinions and interpretations from a myopic perspective. A different and deeper level of understanding is needed than is available. With what I'm doing, I don't have time to look into that, all of it. So I look for the people who are at the fringe of the study of history, people like Velikovsky, Michael Telegin, and all those many others who open up our mind to the realization that history is much older, much larger, much more encompassing, and goes much deeper than the school books can tell you. So it always comes back to the same realization. If you want to really do it your way, you have to do it yourself. And then it is really wonderful that through the internet and through the interests which it opens up, you can now find so much more about the old histories and the old memories than was available, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago. If you look back 100 years ago, when people already started to explore this, Lubitsch was describing this symbology of Egypt and showed that there was something really different going on. Those people had an understanding which was not about deities and gods in the Roman Catholic slave master sense, but the understanding of natural principles, of natural philosophy encoded in terminology of fundamental principles. And you cannot call the fundamental principle gods, and you cannot really represent them, so you need to do that in a symbolic way. So he and many others already started to do that, but in the history books you don't find that, so you really need to look for that yourself, and then you can really find a lot of very fascinating information. Perhaps it's easiest to realize, well, maybe it's, I can just say how I work with that. As I said, when I find that kind of information, I take it at face value. I just assume that people who describe it could not describe it otherwise. So that's the way they can tell the story. Then I need to look at the context. When was it? And what kind of culture did they have at that time? It's a bit like St. John's University of Good Books. They studied seven cultures in seven different time slots with seven different languages. And so the students needed to, in a way, in their mind, dive into that period. Descartes, when he was writing that, what was the political historical context in France? Plato, when he was describing his stuff, what kind of setting was that in Greece, and how was the relationship between Greece and Egypt? And in that way, in history, it is necessary to look back at what was the context, what was the time, what kind of technology, what kind of language did the people have, how far did they travel, how many other people did they meet, what kind of biotope and what kind of food did they have, because all of those factor in how they were able to interact with their environment, but also why they thought some things more important than others. And so that would become part of their story, because you will always find that the things which are self-evident to people, they're most often omitted from the stories. How many novels do you read where they actually describe the kind of loo paper that they use, or the kind of toilet that they sit on, and how the water flushes over the very many ages? They don't describe it because they assume that everybody already knows that, because it is a common factor in the lives of everybody. So the self-evident is often ignored if you look at history. So you really need to do detective work. First you need to accept the story as is, then you need to recontextualize it, then you need to look for the hidden information, the lost information, or the self-evident information, and then you still need to look at the intent. Why was it important for these people to describe that? And does that still have validity now? When it was important there, were there other cultures at that same time zone, in that same time slice, or in that same continent many generations later or earlier, who also found that important, or did their interest shift? So history is not just a simple recorded story of something, but it is as if you need to regard that as a seed of knowledge. And then you need to plant it, and then you need to water it with your intention, and then you need to see what grows out of that. And that is quite a fascinating experience in history, and you'll get to know many historians who were defiled and ignored by the people around them, but who nevertheless are probably the only people who open your mind to something beyond the repeated story that everybody repeats, and for which they get the degrees and the professorial salaries. Because to have knowledge is wonderful, but to be able to expand knowledge is much better. To have an ego is practical, but to develop your soul is much more important. And the study of history in that way is a bit like the discovery of the soul of humanity, and I can really recommend to look into it.